repairing and improving Jacksonville schools. Now that the voters have spoken on that half-cent sales tax, the work gets underway. Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, a conversation with Duval County School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. Get on the line now. Join us. It's 549-2937. Then later we'll tell you how you can help the less fortunate around town this holiday. And all you have to do is fill up an old shoebox. We'll explain. But first this hour, the latest on the pandemic. Grim news. The U.S. saw its highest number of new daily COVID-19 cases since the virus first entered the country in the spring. On Saturday, according to Johns Hopkins University, this country reported 126,742 new cases of coronavirus. And in Florida, we saw a single-day increase of 6,820 cases. That's another big jump. And for the second consecutive day, the Agency for Healthcare Administration added more than 100 currently hospitalized patients with a primary diagnosis of COVID-19. The bottom line here, people, is the cases continue to climb. The virus is still very much with us, and this winter could be difficult. So please, please remain vigilant. We are not done with this. Keep wearing a mask. Keep socially distancing. Don't go to large indoor gatherings where people aren't following these protocols. Let's all work together on this. All right. The election is over, and we have a new president in this country. President-elect Joe Biden and his wife Jill move into the White House in January. And by the way, the new First Lady says she will continue her work as an educator while also serving as First Lady. This will be an absolute first for this country. Speaking of education, after a very long campaign, voters in Duval County also said yes on Election Day to a half-cent sales tax measure to improve and repair local schools. Duval County Superintendent Dr. Diana Green is on the line to tell us all about how this victory will impact education here on the First Coast. Dr. Green, good morning and thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back on the show. What are your questions, everyone, for Duval Superintendent Dr. Diana Green as we talk about the passage of the half-cent sales tax for Duval County schools? Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937 to join us. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaNJax. Our Facebook page is open to you as well. Well, Dr. Green, first off, congratulations. This is a very big deal for the Duval County Public Schools. You and your team worked very hard on this, so you must be feeling pretty good this week.
We feel really, really well this week. We are thankful to not just our team, but to our community. Our community saw fit to invest in public education, and we're just excited.
Absolutely. So let's talk about what this means. As voters said yes to a half-cent sales tax increase, this will raise nearly $2 billion to pay for improvements across the school district over the next 15 years. By the way, this referendum passed handily, 67% to 33%. So the voters are solidly behind you. Tell us a little bit about your plans now to start implementing these funds and how they'll be used.
Well, tomorrow we will present to our school board at our workshop tomorrow the plans that we would start the process. But our board also has a critical part in this, and they are establishing the Independent Oversight Committee, Independent Citizens Oversight Committee. And as that committee is being put together, we are preparing to present to that committee the projects that are slated in phase one. We made a commitment that safety and security was a priority and that we will touch all schools within the first 3 years. So that those projects will be coming out much quicker than the projects such as replacing a school or adding new footprint, which means we could be adding a wing or doing a complete renovation, modernization, those projects will take a little more time than the safety and security.
Sure. And I know you've brought this up on this show several times in the past, but for people who haven't followed this closely, can you name check some of the schools around town that have really had the biggest problems, crumbling infrastructure, no working air conditioning, all the kinds of issues that you've been looking at?
Well, Annie Morgan is probably one of our oldest schools in Duval County. It's over 120 years. Henry Kite, that school has had a number of issues and is very old. But the number one school that needs what we call a replacement would be Rutledge Pearson. That would be the first school that we would develop the prototype to rebuild a brand new K-5 elementary school. A lot of our high schools, it's about portables. Sandalwood High School, our largest high school, has close to 40 portables. The goal is to replace all those portables with brick and mortar. High schools like Mandarin High School also, right now, I think, is slated for a 32-classroom wing to be added to replace all of the portables. Kirby Smith is a very old school. It needs a complete modernization. The goal with Kirby Smith is to also keep that architectural tradition of people who were concerned about historic buildings, getting rid of those buildings. That is not in our plan, but it's to go inside the building and completely modernize it.
Wow, that's quite a list. And to be clear, let's explain once again, and I know you did a lot of explaining about this to the voters out there. We have the oldest school buildings in the state of Florida here in Jacksonville, don't we?
Yes. Yes, we have the oldest buildings in the state of Florida. The average, by using DOE formula, is 44 years. But if you just look at original date that the building was erected, the average age is more like 62 years old.
62 years old. Certainly buildings start to show signs of wear and tear at that point. And so as you work on this, some of the lowest income neighborhoods of Duval will be seeing the greatest flow of the taxpayer funds. And that is by design. You've weighted this toward the age of the buildings and the need of the communities. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Absolutely. Although District 4 and 5, yes, the funding would be weighted to those two districts. Those two districts also are having to sacrifice the most because we're building new footprint by consolidating schools. So we're not just building one building for one school. We're building a brand new school and combining two or three schools into that brand new facility. So we are moving in a direction of the facilities that are the oldest yet underutilized. The goal was if we combine those school populations, then we want to do it in a brand new K-5 facility. So although they have, if you put it in a pie and cut up the pieces, these two districts have the largest piece, these two districts also have the oldest, some of the oldest facilities in Duval County.
We're speaking now with Duval County School Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. You, the voters of Jacksonville, approved a half-cent sales tax for the Duval County schools. And this morning, we're learning how that money's going to be spent. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Let us know your thoughts and questions. Nick is on the north side. Hi, Nick. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I voted against not because of the half-cent tax increase, not because I'm against having new schools or serviceable schools in places where we need them, especially these depleted neighborhoods. But for several other reasons. First of all, it's a regressive tax increase. In other words, poor people pay disproportionately more so than rich people. It's a way of shifting the tax burden from rich people to poor people. Once again, we've done it again in Duval County. The other point I wanted to make is that these buildings are not going to be built at cost. Everyone needs to remember that. So all these construction companies, I mean, I'm assuming that's true. All these construction companies that build these buildings, there's going to be profit in it for them. And so now here we are subsidizing. It's basically, this turns out to be a giant subsidy for WW Gay or whoever it is that's building the buildings. And it's all coming from this half-cent sales tax, which is hurts poor people, working people more than it does the wealthy. It's just amazing that in this town, and then finally, in this time of this pandemic, where nothing is probably going to be the same when this thing is over with, we may be shifting away from schools where children attend in person. So for all these reasons, this was the dumbest thing that I think that Jacksonville's ever done, and that's really saying something. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, Nick. Dr. Green, let's take his points one by one, because those that took issue with this method of revenue raising said it was a regressive tax. Now, I know you've explained this on this program before, but you went this route because it was the only legal option available to you. Isn't that right?
That is correct. We're only allowed to put on a referendum a half-cent sales tax for capital improvements or capital purchases. So, unfortunately, to that gentleman's concern, this was the only legal route we were allowed to take. I do want to point out that the items that are very important to families, such as medication, pharmacy, those things aren't taxed, and so they won't be. This tax won't apply to those type services that aren't taxed.
Yeah, and he also mentioned he sees this as a giveaway to local construction firms and such. The thing is, though, as you mentioned, these buildings are old, and over time you have to either replace them or fix them up. That's to me just a reality of the situation.
Well, it's also an opportunity for economic growth in our community. The construction companies will be hiring individuals who need jobs. So this isn't built at cost, as he stated, but we go through a very rigorous RFP process. Companies have to participate in that RFP process. That's why we have an oversight committee to ensure that we are utilizing taxpayer dollars effectively and to the projects that we indicated would be in our plan.
Lots of calls for Duval Superintendent Dr. Diana Green. Susan is in Mandarin. Susan, good morning.
Yes, please ask Dr. Green about the allowable use by charter schools. I was wondering specifically, can our sales tax money be spent on building privately owned facilities that will house charter schools? And if they can, is there any way for the school district to recoup that money if the privately owned charter school is closed or if the building is sold? Melissa Ross had Ms. Miller and Mr. Chartrand on in 2019, and Ms. Miller did say that there needed to be stronger clawback provisions in the state when they passed HB 7097, forcing us to give our sales tax money to charter schools, usurping the school board's authority. They did not put in stricter clawback provisions as far as I could find. So I'm wondering what kind of authority the Citizen Oversight Committee can have over charter schools. Recently, there is an ordinance in City Council 2020-627 that is a bond for the KIPP Charter School to get more money. And I tried to read it, but I unfortunately didn't understand it. Hopefully, you could explain it to me on who will, if that bond is going to be repaid by our sales tax money. And if it is going to be repaid by our sales tax money, who is going to own that building? Because my understanding is now is the KIPP Charter School that's existing now, that charter school is in a building that is owned by someone else, and then the charter school pays rent. And Senator Gibson did suggest an amendment to 7097 that would have put stricter control over the charter school spending our sales tax money, but the GOP-dominated legislator did not pass it. Anyway,
all right.
In short, my question is what the Citizen Oversight Committee. Thank
you. Yep. Thanks, Susan. Dr. Green.
Well, there were several questions in there.
Yeah, there was a lot in there. But that shows you how closely voters are following this.
Yeah. Number one, we are required to share funding with charter schools based on their FTE. Their plans do not have to be approved by the school district. However, they must follow the plans that were in the resolution. And those plans are very broad, such as you can build new buildings, you can use the funding for lease payments, you can use the funding for repairs, you can use the funding for technology. They have those same allowances as we do. They will have to report to the oversight committee. As it relates to clawback, when I've met Susan, and when we discussed this, the clawback was when the law wasn't in place, when it was just going to be the school district that would share some of the funds. But because those are public dollars, if a charter school closes, the school district, can an allowable clawback, the school district seeks to do so. The issue with the city and the bond, if a charter school closes, they're people who they owe debt to, they're doing the same thing, trying to get their debt paid back. So it's not a simple answer, yes or no. And there's also some legal ramifications. And since I'm not a lawyer, I'm not going to try to answer that to any great depth. And that's why we have our great legal team that supports our board and school district. And so they will be able to answer Susan's questions probably more detailed than I'm answering it right now.
All right. Thank you for that. Let's get in another call for Superintendent Diana Green. Jim in Jacksonville. Hey, Jim, happy Monday. Let's get the week off to a good start. And thanks for your call. Go ahead.
I just have one question because I think the other question about the charter schools has been kind of covered. I would like to know, with regards to the priority on security budget, how much of the budget as a percentage are we talking about? My concern is, for instance, Ms. DeVos, who's our education secretary for the country, is paid a government salary of a couple hundred thousand dollars, but her security detail for the last 4 years was $24 million, and nobody ever asked me about that, and they certainly haven't disclosed until recently. And it's just outrageous that we have spent so much money on something like that. So my question is, how much of this money are we talking about for something that's going to be basically going away each day, as opposed to what our intent was to, you know, do permanent or long-term improvements?
Okay. Thanks, Jim. Dr. Green, school security.
Yes, I don't know the exact percentage. I believe we're spending close to $80 million. And when we talk about safety and security, we're talking about facility safety and security. So fencing, door locks, replacing all classroom door locks. So when the classroom door closes, it automatically locks. Vestibules, so that when someone enters into a school, they need another doorway to go through before they have access to the entire school. So all of our safety and security dollars are not, they're not spent on personnel. They're not spent on operational resources. It can only be spent on facility improvements or capital purchases.
All righty. And before we let you go, Dr. Green, can you take a moment to just update us on how the school year is going amidst this pandemic, as you've shoulder this massive challenge of educating students, but keeping them and teachers and staff safe, dealing with occasional clusters of COVID at local schools. How are things going now, and how do you see the rest of the school year unfolding in the middle of all this?
Well, we are managing pretty well. All of our schools are back in session in brick and mortar, and we still have our students who are participating on Duval homeroom. Approximately 75% of our students are in brick and mortar. We have evolved through this pandemic. Our dashboard is going through an update, so probably later this week there'll be a new enhanced dashboard for our families to continue to check to see where schools are as it relates to COVID-19 positive cases. In addition, I want to reiterate what you stated at the beginning of the hour. We have to remain committed to all the things that we're doing at school because it seems to be working, such as wearing masks, frequent hand washing, socially distancing whenever possible. We need our students and staff to do the same thing when they're not at school. We also are highly encouraging everyone to get a flu shot so that we can not have to try to worry about both viruses. And again, students, if someone tests positive in your family or you are not, or you've tested, please stay home. If you do not feel well, please stay home. Contact your school, and your school will help you figure out classwork and anything else you need. But the more that we are vigilant with the strategies that we both mentioned, as well as taking advantage of many times you can get a free flu shot and staying home when you're not feeling well, we're more likely to mitigate and slow down the spread of COVID-19. And I just have to commend our educators, our teachers, our paraprofessionals, our school-based administrators, everyone who makes sure that students are picked up from home to get to school and delivered back home. They're doing a phenomenal job of still focusing on our main mission, which is teaching and learning. And I'm just very proud of Duval County Public School, from the board, from our board to our classrooms. Everyone is working really hard and trying to do everything to keep us in session, in brick and mortar.
Well, thank you so much, as always, for taking time out to update all the listeners out there. She's Superintendent Dr. Diana Green, Superintendent of the Duval County Public Schools. Dr. Green, thanks.
Thank you, Melissa. I enjoy your show.
Thanks so much. Thank you. Right. And much more still ahead on this show. Later in the hour, we've got an easy way for you to help the less fortunate this holiday here on the First Coast. And all you got to do is fill up an old shoebox. We'll tell you about that. But up next.
Veterans have learned a skill or a trade. Those things are marketable, for the most part, out here in the private sector.
How veterans could take advantage of opportunities to transition into civilian life and start their own business. It's part of our week-long celebration of veterans on the First Coast here on the show. We'll tell you about it after this. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Marco Werman. Around the globe, people are pondering a Biden presidency. In Iran,
people are really feeling the pain of the sanctions that the U.S. has been imposing, and they would love to see these sanctions eased.
And in Russia,
he might tighten the screws and might take a harder line.
How Joe Biden might change U.S. direction on the world.
Tomorrow at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Agata Gardner, and I'm a volunteer on WJCT's Community Advisory Board. I grew up listening to public radio, and my son now is starting to value it. He'll ask follow-up questions that make it clear to me that he gets it, that that's a complicated issue, and I think it is starting in his own little six-year-old mind. to make him realize that the world isn't black and white. And I think that WJCT does a really great job in bringing integrity to the news. This is WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, Veterans Day is this Wednesday, and there will be a parade downtown and other observances in Jacksonville. Veterans Small Business Week just wrapped up. And veterans transitioning to civilian life in this community more often than not decide to start their own business. Bernie Dandridge of Florida Capital Bank says there are plenty of resources here in our area for men and women who have served. Take a listen. Bernie, good to be with you. Thanks for joining the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about veterans in this community and Vets Small Business Week. You know, Florida has one of the largest populations of veterans in the country. Jacksonville is a hub for local veterans, of course, with our strong military presence. And veterans, according to your data, they're more likely to be self-employed. So what's the message you're trying to get out about resources available to vets in our community during Veterans Small Business Week?
Well, I think the biggest thing veterans need to be aware of is that there's plenty of educational opportunities. Veterans are, you know, most of them have learned a skill or a trade or a particular unique function, work function, maybe logistics, maybe other things, while they were in the service. And those things are marketable, for the most part, out here in the private sector. And many veterans will look at their military experience and say, you know, gosh, I could do government contracting work even with my old department or even an old area that I used to work in the military as a private citizen. And a lot of folks will go into that type of a direction. You know, we have a client down south of here that does a lot of government contract procurement. And so there's a lot of that stuff that goes on. A lot of that's available to the veteran. And in addition to that, there's educational opportunities through the Small Business Development Center here at UNF. There's other educational opportunities through SBA for them to learn for free. And there's just some great things. We find that veterans, because of the discipline that they have learned over through their time in the military and the contacts that they have, the relationships they've built, are often very good business entrepreneurs.
Right. So it's a natural transition. What are some of the biggest pain points or challenges that veterans are dealing with out there that you see, and what's your advice to them to make this leap?
Well, I think like any small business owner, the biggest challenge is making sure that they understand all the different elements that impact their profitability or their ability to drive revenue, sales. And so for that, they need to get some education and some support, and that's why I'm such a big advocate of the Small Business Development Center at UNF. They can for free give you some of the best education and quickest customized knowledge for your particular field or area that you want to work in of anybody in the country, really. And so I recommend that all small business owners actively participate with the SBDC. Just today, I spent some time on the phone with a woman-owned business who was an SBDC client. And she's a nurse practitioner starting her own practice. And she had done a tremendous amount of work with the SBDC and was completely prepared for her conversation with me about financing. That's a big advantage because a lot of times we receive a phone call from someone and you know, they're really disorganized about how they're approaching. They know they need capital, but they don't really understand how to put together the package. And that's one of the big things that the SBDC can do in addition to many other areas.
All right. Now, of course, we are in the middle of a pandemic and a recession. It's tough to transition from the military to the private sector anyway. Opening a business is tough for anyone.
But there are special challenges right now. And when people come into a bank like yours and they're seeking financing, they're bringing in a lot of baggage. What else are you seeing out there that is creating special hurdles in this time we're living through? And what advice do you have for people?
Well, let me give you a very important comment about that, and that is that every small business owner should have a specific written COVID plan. Certainly people who are new in business or starting business should have a written COVID plan. And what I mean by that is that they should have an idea of how COVID is going to impact their ability to drive clientele. As an example, I have a client in Tallahassee who is a business owned by three veterans, two of them disabled, and it is a microbrewery. And originally, the way they put the business together was doing great. But with COVID, nobody could come to the microbrewery, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they had to change their whole marketing approach. And they went out and started developing relationships with people in the grocery store business and other areas where they could get some shelf space. They did anything they could to figure out a way to drive revenue. So when I say develop a COVID plan, think about how COVID is going to impact your business in your ability to meet customers. Let me give you one more example. We have a restaurant client here in town who started off like way back in November, I believe they started and they opened up. But March rolled around, of course, COVID hit, and now people can't come into the restaurant. So they very quickly decided that they would create dinner time packages for people so that you could actually order a dinner for four or six people online, and then you would come, and they gave you a selection of dinners that you could order, and you would come by their shop. And you would have a prepackaged, basically a dinner that you would take home and warm up or take care of and be able to sit down and feed your family, and it would be great. So that was a creative idea that they came up with to satisfy their clientele. We have a farm client who used to sell primarily just to restaurants, and they decided that what they would do is start a farm-to-table business. And so different ways of marketing that COVID forced them out of their normal delivery process of moving goods and services to customers, they had to change their whole approach. And that new approach has been very, very good, and it's something that they will continue to do after COVID is more managed. And there's lots of examples mm-hmm. like that, and it's very exciting out there today. I'll tell you, I'm just writing an email right now to my senior credit folks to tell them that we're getting a lot of inquiries about business expansions. We're getting inquiries about a few business startups. So there are definitely people out there today that are working toward business growth and business beginnings. So even in spite of the pandemic and in spite of the down cycle in the economy as a result of the pandemic, remember, the down cycle in the economy is a specific result of the pandemic. It's not a result of something that happened economically in society. So there's a lot of underneath structure in the business community that once you start taking COVID out of the mix, either by your plans or by the fact that a vaccine or more therapeutics will be out there and it's more manageable, you'll be able to be more successful with your new business or with your existing company.
Well, that's good news. We'll leave it on that hopeful note. And I want to thank you, Bernie Dandridge, the Small Business Association and USDA Small Biz Development Specialist. He's with the Jacksonville-based Florida Capital Bank as we talk about Veterans Small Business Week. Bernie, thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much. God bless y'all. Bye-bye.
Well, from holiday pop-up stores to some amazing new public art, the cultural community is very busy as we head into the festive season. Yes, it's that time. Ellen Cottrell coordinates programs and public engagement with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacks, and she's on the line. Hey, Ellen, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Great to hear your voice, and I know the Cultural Council has a lot going on. Let's begin with the public art project you've been working on. It's on the Water Street parking garage in downtown Jacksonville. So tell us what's happening there.
Well, we have, I'm sure if you've driven over the bridge coming into the Water Street entrance into downtown, you've seen that very cool mural that was on the plane. Very plain-looking bridge that was, a parking garage that was gray and black, and now there's this very cool, there are musical notes, it's sort of a colorful design on there, and we've been waiting for several months for the missing piece, the cherry on the top, the beautiful sculpture that's supposed to be part of that exhibit or that installation. So because of COVID, because of fires out west and all kinds of things, it's been delayed. The artists are out in Seattle. Finally, we had it, and it arrived on Saturday. You can see pictures of it. There's some on our Facebook and on our website. This very cool sculpture by the artists, Haddad and Duggan, and they will be in town all week long installing it. They'll be on the top of the Water Street Garage. They'll be installing it from the roof. You can go, you can take a look, and then on Monday evening, 5:30 to 6:15, we'll be having the big reveal. We'll be putting the lights on and seeing it all in its glory. We're really excited about it. It's just such a wonderful entrance into the city.
And this is a week from tonight you'll be doing that?
A week from tonight, yep. And Landstar Trucking just generously donated. They had trucks out there. They brought it all the way here from Seattle. So we are just so grateful for that. They sponsored that, which was just such a great thing for the city, a gift for the city, really, that they did that. The artists will be here all week installing. They'll be there Monday night for the big reveal. We invite everyone to come and check it out.
Fantastic. And this is part of a big effort through the Art in Public Places initiative, isn't it, to just radically expand the public art we can enjoy around the city?
Yeah, there's been a lot lately. On Laura Street, Laura's Flower went in next to, right in front of the new visitor center, and that went in with help of Farrah and Farrah near their offices. There's been another installation that ByStars was helping with by downtown. There's all kinds of things in the works, too. It's going to be a great year for public art. To mention all the amazing murals that have gone around and what Art Republic has done all over the city, and especially by the Jesse Ball DuPont. If you haven't seen all the mosaics and the art around there, it's just incredible.
Yeah. If you haven't been into the urban core lately, just come downtown, drive around. You'll really be amazed at the beauty and the vibrancy of all of these projects. Now, Ellen, let me ask you as well about the Cultural Council's pop-up holiday store that you're doing at the Markets at Town Center. You're partnering up with the UNF LGBTQ Resource Center on this. This is a way people can holiday shop, support locally made products, and tell us how this is coming together.
As you know, it's the second year that we're doing this, and Markets of Town Center and their parent company, Heinz, have graciously and amazingly supported it, given us the space, given us financial help to staff it, all kinds of things, in one of their spaces that's been empty. So this year, you've been there last year, you saw it was a beautiful gallery. This year, we're at a very more of a centrally located area, right across from Cooper's Hawk. It's a larger gallery. This year we had about 50% more artists apply. We've been able to pretty much accept everybody. We have almost 1,000 pieces of artwork there. It looks amazing. It's, there's 2D, there's 3D, fine art, ceramics, pottery, glass. There's literary art, literary books by local authors, all kinds of things. And then the partnership was really out of Heinz the sponsors, they have a diversity and inclusion initiative that they sponsor with their company. And I guess with all of their projects, they try to include something along those lines to promote diversity and inclusion. So this year, they found the partner at UNF, the Resource Center. So they have a part in the gallery where you can, they have a few artists in there as well, and also an installation, an exhibit that you can go in, and it's actually a very interactive installation that you can come in. There's I don't know how to explain it exactly, but there's actually dressing rooms in the space, and they've set it up so that you can sort of go in and understand what it's like to come out of the closet.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, yeah, you can just go in, look, see. They have all kinds of very interesting banners of people, you know, in our I don't know if they're local or just in our country, nationally, that are part of that community. And it's just a place for dialogue and awareness and a safe location. So we're really excited about having them be part of the gallery.
That's fantastic. So again, keep your eyes out for the new public art at the Water Street parking garage. That's right as you come into downtown Jacksonville. They'll be working on it all week and have the big official debut next Monday night. And then also, when you start your holiday shopping, make sure to swing by the Cultural Council pop-up holiday store. This is at the Markets at Town Center. And as you said, Ellen, it's next to Cooper's Hawk. Is that right? And these,
yep, so across the parking lot, across the street, you'll see it. There's all kinds of signage. Also, we're having, so we opened officially on Saturday, but this coming Saturday from 4 to 7 is sort of our grand opening. Outside, we'll have a live mural artist doing from 4 to 7 doing a mural. We'll have live music. Everything, we're going to be keeping it socially distanced as we do it. So as you come into the gallery, just kind of be aware of how many people are in there and filter through, do your shopping and enjoy it. But be aware of, you know, how many people, and we'll be keeping track of that. But we really encourage everyone to come by. And we'll be open Tuesday through Saturday, 11 to 7, and on Sundays, 12 to 6.
Check it out, everyone. This is a great way to shop local and buy amazing artisanal products that you can't get anywhere else in this community. Thank you so much, Ellen. Ellen Cottrell coordinates programs and public engagement with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa. Bye-bye.
A quick break, but in a moment, we'll be right back with a very easy idea on how you can help the less fortunate this holiday season. And all it involves is an old shoebox. We'll explain after this.
I'm Marco Werman. Around the globe, people are pondering a Biden presidency. In Iran,
people are really feeling the pain of the sanctions that the U.S. has been imposing, and they would love to see these sanctions eased.
And in Russia,
he might tighten the screws and might take a harder line.
How Joe Biden might change U.S. direction on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Tanya Mosley. The B-52s and REM put Athens, Georgia on the music map, but Pylon might have been everyone's favorite band there. A new box set documents Pylon's influential music. We'll have their story and the latest election news next time on Here and Now.
Today at 1 on WJCT News 89.9.
On the next Fresh Air, Megan Rapinoe, co-captain of the world champion U.S. women's national soccer team. She helped the team win 2 World Cups and an Olympic gold medal. She was one of the first high-profile athletes to take the knee following NFL star Colin Kaepernick's original protest in 2016. She has a new memoir. Join us.
Today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Nine out of 10 black women, 4 out of 5 black men, and 2/3 of Latinos voted for Joe Biden, the next president of the United States. But it's the white vote that went to Donald Trump and turned this election into a nail-biter. What does it say about the country right now and where we're headed? I'm Jen White. Join me for that conversation next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, City Rescue Mission wants you to fill up a shoebox to help those in need this holiday season. This is easy and anyone can do it. I learned more from CEO Penny Kivett. Take a listen.
Penny Kivett, good to hear your voice. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, Melissa, thanks so much for having us on here today. It's great.
Great to have you. It's getting that to be that time of year. We're heading into the holiday season already. And City Rescue Mission does such great work in this community. You've got a new initiative this November. It's called Shoeboxes of Love. Tell us about how people can support this.
Doesn't it just make you grin when you hear Shoeboxes of Love? You know, we've been here 75 years in January, and we're very excited that we bring a little bit of Christmas cheer to all of the people that we help, whether that's the folks that are on the street or the people in our recovery program. And the Shoeboxes of Love actually allows us to do that. Melissa, we're hoping that this community once again just steps up and creates this awesome shoebox that has toiletries and maybe a little Christmas gift. And I noticed it at one of our drugstores the other day that they've got the little candy cane peppermint lifesaver packets. That would be something fun. Maybe a little pair of earrings for a woman's box, and maybe a little doll or a coloring book or something wonderful like that for a children's box, and some gloves for some men. Just let your heart, my hope is that the families can go out and just put together a box that's filled with love, and then we want them to wrap it with one of those smaller sized blankets instead of wrapping paper, with a big bow on it, because you know what, believe it or not, in Florida it does get a little chilly in the evenings, so our homeless friends really love to have those blankets. But we're hoping for at least 5,000 of those boxes to be able to give out on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Wow, this is such an easy way to help out. Take an old shoebox, go to any corner drugstore, Walgreens, CVS, what have you. Get some toiletries, get some soap, some socks, a little gift, toothbrush, toothpaste, as you were saying, shampoo, little things like that, a hairbrush. Whatever you think would be nice to put in a care package for a homeless person or a struggling person, wrap it in the blanket and then bring it to City Rescue Mission. Now,
that's
you
correct.
Are located at 426 McDuff. So you want people,
right.
With COVID, are you asking people to just leave these at the front door? How can we drop off our shoeboxes?
We already have people that are stationed down there to take boxes as people drive. So nobody has to get out, come in. We are right there at your car ready to get them out of the trunk or back seat or wherever you might have them. So we'll make it very easy for folks.
That is easy. And Penny, share a little bit more about City Rescue Mission, your history in the community, and what you're hoping to achieve this season.
City Rescue Mission, you know, as I already said, it's been around for nearly 75 years, a month away, and we have helped hundreds of thousands of people do two things. Number one, either get off the street because they have a need for a job or shelter. Those would be the folks that we call our guests, or some might call them the homeless. And we also have an 18-month residential recovery program that has an amazing success rate. It's not a short-term 30-day program. It's an 18-month long program. But what they get through that, Melissa, is just an amazing, amazing opportunity to truly have their lives transformed.
Right. And of course, like any nonprofit, in addition to the shoeboxes of love, you always welcome monetary donations as we head into the holiday season. Yes?
We do. You know, our recovery program is 100% privately funded. And so, yes, what we certainly do love and are happy to take any monetary donation from anyone that would like to support City Rescue Mission.
It's crmjax.org. And here's the deal, everyone. Just grab an old shoebox. You probably have some under your bed. Go to the nearest drugstore. Fill it up with items that people can use. As Penny was saying, toothbrush, toothpaste, razor, soap, socks, brush or comb, body lotion, a book or toy for a child.
A piece of candy or two.
Yeah, some candy. it's a care package. It's a care package.
Yes.
Wrap it in a blanket and then drop it off at the City Rescue Mission McDuff Campus at 426 McDuff Avenue South. Again, it's crmjax.org. CEO Penny Kiewit, good to hear your voice, and I will definitely be dropping off a box. So thank you so much.
Great, Melissa.
Thank you so much.
Happy holidays to you.
You too.
That's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our station news director is Jessica Palumbo, and Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming. We love your feedback. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed any part of today's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock over the air, or our podcast today, wherever you listen. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great Monday.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.